All right. Well, so we are continuing our study of the book of Daniel, and we've been reminded that the book of Daniel includes several visions of future events. And last week we saw the rise of a despicable person, as the text would indicate, vile person, despicable, depending on which version you use, Antiochus the Fourth or Antiochus Epiphanes. And so we want to continue looking at the vision that is found in, or is kind of prepared for, in chapters 10 and then 11, kind of goes into the more specific detail, and then working on into chapter 12 as well. But we spent some time looking at the earlier part of chapter 11, and now we're going to look at the last few verses, verses 36 through 45 of Daniel chapter 11. So the vision expands on the details of the previous visions. It's really important, I think, to see that it is a building process, because you get a summary of kind of some of the events, and you go back and you hit those again, and then you have more detail given and expanded on as we see that. In the revelation that was given to Daniel in chapter 9, there was the delineation of the 70 sevens that were noted there, Daniel 9, 24 to 27. And what we see of those things that the angel Gabriel had told the prophet at that time, those items that took place in verses 24 through 26 have already happened. Those things are now, for us, past tense. They were still future tense for Daniel at the time, but now those are past tense. So those verses describe what would happen in the first 69 sevens. Then verse 27 predicts things that have not yet happened, and it reveals what will happen in the 70th of those weeks of years of that time. So verse 27 is sort of a break between what had already happened and then what is yet to happen. And there's a similar break that we find in the chapter of 11 between verses 35 and 36. So what was predicted in verses 2 through 35 have already happened from our time perspective. And so what follows in this chapter, it has not yet happened. And so most scholars believe that the preceding verses describe Antiochus Epiphanes, but when you get to verse 36, there's something different, and they've come to the conclusion that this must be what we refer to as Antichrist. It doesn't say it in that text, but when you look at other New Testament texts, you see there's a parallel, and so we assume this is referring to the same person. And there isn't any commentator that claims that there is a precise fulfillment of this chapter currently, so it is then understood as yet future. And then in later Revelation, like in the Olivet Discourse in the book of Revelation, those things that the angel told Daniel in these verses must refer to the last of Daniel's 70 weeks. And so we understand that that would be the case. So this is the last seven-year period before Christ returns to earth to establish his kingdom. And Jesus calls it a time of great tribulation in Matthew 24, 21. And the angel that is addressing Daniel here indicates that this will be the worst period of distress that the Jews have ever seen. And that's noted in chapter 1, 12, verse 1, and also referenced in Jeremiah 30, verse 7. Therefore, it seems reasonable to conclude that what follows will occur in that seven-year period, or the tribulation period. So we understand that those things that are referenced here refer to a particular person who has yet to be revealed during the tribulation period, and that's what is addressed in verses 36 through 45. So this is understood to be a jump ahead in time. And there are things about this person that parallel the previous person that had been emphasized, that is Antiochus Epiphanes. There are things that are parallel between them in terms of their character, nature, and some of the things that they do. And, of course, the New Testament then is going to give us more information on that. Then we want to think about the nature and mindset of this world leader who has yet to be recognized, yet to be revealed, yet to come. We don't know who it is or just when he's going to come on the world scene, but sometime in the future. Could be he's already here. We don't know that. Looking at verses 36 to 37, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall execute and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. So we want to think about the character of this leader. He will be known for being a rebelliously self-willed. There's a time indicator in this text, which helps give some context. The then signals a leap in time to the distant future. The text later indicates in verse 40 that the king of the north will storm against him. So if it's the king of the north, and it can't be Antiochus Epiphanes because he was a king of the north, and the king of the south will also come against him, so it can't be Antiochus Epiphanes. It has to be someone other than that. So this predicted king will have the power to do as he pleases. Apparently he will not be subject to any other higher human authority. And that is comparable to what is noted in Revelation chapter 13, 1 through 10 and 17:12. He will exalt himself higher than any other god, which implies that he will demand worship. And, of course, 2 Thessalonians 2:4 and again Revelation 13:11-18 and 17:12-13 correspond to that as far as a New Testament text that parallels that kind of character that's going to be exhibited. And then he will also repudiate the true God, also noted in Revelation 17:14. He will succeed for a time. He will be very effective until God's indignation against his people, the Jews, have run its course. In other words, once his work is done, then he will no longer be the one who's commanding things in charge. He will be appropriately judged. But all of this is going to happen under the ultimate authority of God, the true God. And so God is allowing that. Then he will exercise his freedom to disregard God. This verse gives more information about the leader's religious convictions, or we might say the lack thereof. There's a reference here, that there's a phrase, the God, or it could be gods of his fathers. It's similar to what's used elsewhere in Scripture that describes the God of the Jews. And that has led some interpreters to conclude that this king may be a Jew, but the phrase does not require that that's the interpretation, because the name God here is Elohim. It's the general word for God, rather than the covenant name Yahweh that's often used in stressing the relationship between God and his covenant people. But then the word Elohim also may have a plural translation, and often is, depending on the context, gods, or singular God, and can be used of the true God. So it's not definitive. Other revelation about this man may indicate that he could be a Roman, someone from Europe, for instance. Chapter 7, verse 8 of Daniel, verse 24, Revelation 13:1-10, seem to indicate there's a correlation there. But then, of course, he could be Jewish and Roman, but the verse doesn't really give us a very specific, clearly identifying him as a Jew or not, but it might be, could be. We just don't know. Probably the angel, in communicating this, was indicating that this king would abandon the religion of his past, whatever that religion may have been. It's, again, not definitive. And he will do this because he will set himself up as the object of worship in the place of all gods. Then there's another phrase that's used here, the desire of women. What exactly is that referring to? Some suggest that it may be a reference to the Messiah, because there were many women in Daniel's day and other times that wanted to be the bearer of the Messiah. So that could be understood that way. Another view is that it's referring to Tammuz. Of course, Jeremiah refers to the women weeping for Tammuz, which was a pagan goddess that was around in Daniel's time as well, that women found an interest in giving attention in a form of worship to that goddess as well. But others believe that it may be that this meant that the king will have no desire for women. And some even speculate that he might be abusive toward women, but the basic idea is that he would be without natural affection. And I would tend to prefer that third view in that regard. Then looking at verses 38 to 39, it says, "But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain." Well, this seems to indicate something of the priorities of this leader. He will honor a god of fortresses. What this king will really trust is in a god who he believes will give him military success. It may not be a god in a religious sense. I mean, you hear of people making something their god or idolizing something. He would maybe be idolizing power. It could be more than that, but it could be something as simple as just wanting to have an emphasis on power and the military force that he can utilize in the process of essentially conquering the world or all those around him. It seems that there's an indication that his forefathers would have acknowledged some supreme being or maybe some pagan god, but his god is going to be perhaps seen as spending money on his military arsenal. He would be more materialistic, not supernaturally oriented, maybe because he wants to make himself out to be God or be the focus of people's interest, attention, worship, etc. So the exact nature and the identification of the God here that's associated with fortresses is not really nailed down. It's somewhat speculative. But he will act against the strongest fortresses. The foreign god referred to in this verse may be a god of military might that's mentioned in verse 38, or it could be some other foreign god that he uses to his own end, again, or it could be himself. Again, not definitive. And part of the problem is it hasn't happened yet, so we don't know for sure what it's going to look like other than comparing it to what we see in other texts that parallel this individual. And he may be somewhat like Antiochus, who came before him and is one who would be loyal or who would reward those who had been loyal to him by bestowing honors on them or giving them positions of authority. Maybe it was a matter of paying bribes to get people to do what he wanted them to do, or maybe just reward for those who are faithful to him, like giving land to those who do what he asks, etc. You recall that when we were looking at Antiochus Epiphanes, he was noted for being manipulative to get people to do what he wanted, and he would use whatever resources were at his disposal. And the indication seems to be that this individual, this world leader who would be to come that we would associate with Antichrist is very comparable. And that's why they are juxtaposed together here in this way. Then the delineation of conflict with the world leader. Looking at verses 40 and 41. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now this, again, is another interesting section to look at. This leader will prevail. Oh, it keeps jumping more than I want. Am I jumping ahead there? This leader will prevail against formidable opposition. He will be the object of attacks from the south and from the north. Again, if these are the kings of the south and the north are differentiated from this individual, then he must not be associated with Antiochus Epiphanes. It must not be him, because Antiochus Epiphanes was a king of the north. So that's why we come to that conclusion. The end of time that's referenced here seems to relate to the 70th week of Daniel 9:27. Then this king will be the focus of attacks by the king of the south. That would be south in reference to where Israel is. And the king of the north will also be a force to be reckoned with. And that, again, is in relation to where Israel is. And it's possible that these two kings may attack simultaneously. There seems to be indication then that this king is neither a king of the south or a king of the north, but he is clearly differentiated or distinguished from that. So then in view of Daniel chapter 9, verse 26, it's been assumed that he may be a Western ruler, because the little horn arising out of the Roman Empire was indicated and is associated with the Antichrist, chapter 7, verse 8 of Daniel, and then also verse 24 of chapter 7, again, has that connection there. So there seems to be some association there. Not absolutely certain, but the imagery seems to be somewhat evident. So the opposition and the conflict is recognized as being quite significant. This ruler will invade many countries. He'll overwhelm them. He'll pass through. He'll conquer them. It's interesting when you look at history. There was an occasion when something of this nature happened, and people would have associated it at that time, and that's when the Nazis came through and did have some impact in that area. So we can see, well, there's again another parallel, and this was led by another leader who was someone who had some serious issues, we'll put it that way. One commentator wrote with regard to this passage, says, presumably the warfare will be carried on by armored vehicles and missiles such as are used in modern warfare, though in order to communicate with Daniel's generation, ancient equivalents of these are used here. Likewise, the ancient names of the countries or states occupying the region where the final conflict will be carried on are used in the prediction, though most of these political units will no longer bear these names in the last days. That was, I think, Gleason Archer who had noted that, and I think it's a helpful reminder of our looking at the text and trying to recognize that when the prophecy was given, the technology, the political lines were not necessarily the same as what they are now, but so they would have used the equivalent at that time, and it may be different in our time. The book of Ezekiel also deals with some great military force that will be descending on Israel from the north, assumed to be from more further north than that. Ezekiel didn't mention a power from the south, but he did reference the north, so they may or may not be the same event, but it's possible that it could be so. So this aspect, again, of the fulfillment is probably taking place in the second half of the tribulation, when Israel is going to be suffering its most intense persecution. One writer argued that this king of the north will be a ruler from the area that Assyria formerly occupied, not necessarily someone coming from the far north of Russia or the north area of Russia. There are others who believe that Gog here is a code name meaning dark, and that it could be referring to two similar invaders who descend on Israel at two different times, one at the end of the tribulation and the other at the end of the millennium, because that term is used in both of those cases. So it may or may not, at least in the opinion of some, necessarily be the same exact people. It may be similar. So, but the outcome of this first battle is that the Antichrist will prevail. He will pass through. He will have his impact in that part of the country. So the results of this battle then will have great impact on Israel. The Antichrist will enter this part of the world, and they will fall, or many will fall, before his forces. And he will defeat other countries in addition to Israel. Doesn't disclose just which ones those are, likely some around there. The time frame here, again, is associated with Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, and we want to be reminded of that. It says, "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate." And then, of course, Jesus refers back to this same passage and expands on some of those details as well. So it seems to be indicating that his entering the Holy Land may be after he breaks his covenant with Israel, which would put it at the midpoint of the tribulation period, or it may even involve breaking it in some form or another. And so this would confirm that these events will happen in the last half, again, of the tribulation period, at the time of the end. But there will be a few areas where the Antichrist does not overcome at this time, and it doesn't indicate why that might be. We could speculate, maybe because they are insignificant, maybe because they are not easy to get to. Some of the areas of Edom, Moab, and Ammon, they were located to the east and the south of Israel, the area that's in our present day associated with Jordan. And there's a reference to the foremost of the sons of Ammon that probably refers to maybe the best areas or something of that nature. But all of this would indicate that there is a focus on Israel, which is going to result in a very difficult time for them. It's associated with the end times, and it would be harmful for Israel to be in the spotlight, to be the focus of this Antichrist. Then looking at verses 42 through 45, "He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels." picking up at verse 44, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. And he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So this leader will attack further south, but is ultimately stopped. So we see that he will attack countries further south. That, again, is further south of Israel. He will press his attack and invade other countries. The most noteworthy of them is Egypt, taking control of Egypt. He will plunder Egypt and take treasures from it. That's been done before in history. And this will be another of those occasions. He will bring those that are living in the ancient territories of Libya and Ethiopia under his control. So he's going to be expanding in that area as well. Of course, Libya is to the west of Egypt. Ethiopia is to its south. And this would suggest that he's thinking he's on a roll. He's gaining ground. He's moving in that direction. What all may be his motivation isn't specified in terms of what he's hoping to gain, other than perhaps taking control, taking more to himself. Kind of reminds us of someone like Alexander the Great, who just started conquering and taking up more land and more land and more countries and so on. He will defend his gains and seek to destroy opposition. So he will respond to troubling news that's coming from the east and the north. So that's not an unusual scenario, as we've seen various battles, even in the time frame that we've been looking at, during the times of the northern king, the kings of the north, and the kings of the south. And what had transpired there, when you're involved in a particular attack and you hear news of something else going on that you're having to now divide your ability to accomplish what you want to do. It kind of reminds me of what happened at various times on the Eastern Front in World War II, going toward Russia. And as I recall, Hitler was warned that pressing as he was going to spread out his troops too much, and it was going to be a problem. And that's exactly what happened. He was trying to accomplish too much. He should have had some, I think he did, he was given some advice, but he ignored it, and that was a problem. So anyway, in this case, when there's news of other army enemies from the east and from the north, it's going to be troublesome to him. He's going to want to respond to that. And he does respond with great fury, and he kills many more people. In the passage in Zechariah 13:8, it has reference to two-thirds will die in the context that's there, may be associated with this as well. And then he will not be ultimately successful. He has many successes, but that's going to come to an end. So the text seems to indicate that he's going to return to Israel. His headquarters, it sounds as if they will be in Jerusalem, which stands between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, and the reference to the glorious holy mountain is associated with Mount Moriah on Jerusalem. And so it seems that that's what is in view there. And it's evidently there that he's going to meet his match and suffer defeat, which corresponds to what we see in the book of Revelation and what is recognized there. So let's just take a look at a couple of texts that seem to relate as well, like Revelation 19:19-20, where we read, I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. This is the time of Christ's return. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. And then Zechariah 14:1-4, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, and I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two, from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall be moved toward the north, and half of it toward the south. That again is focused on Jerusalem, Christ's return, and putting an end to the reign of this Antichrist. So with that, let me give a helpful summary that kind of ties these things together about those things that relate to Antichrist. Again, Antichrist is a New Testament term that is parallel to this individual, given the passages that overlap on that. So he will act in self-will, verse 36, he will exalt himself, again, verse 36, he will magnify himself above every god, verse 36, he will blaspheme the true God, verse 36, he will succeed for a limited period of time, again, verse 36, and will be an irreligious person, verse 37. He will also place confidence in military might, verse 38 and 39, his military might will be challenged, verse 40. He will be initially victorious in battle, verses 40 to 43. However, he will face renewed conflict, verse 44, and will establish his headquarters in Jerusalem, verse 45, and will finally come to an end, verse 45. And of course, again, the book of Revelation fills in more details as it relates to some of these things as well. So the remainder of this vision is yet to be considered. We'll save that for next time. But it deals with the impact of all of this on Israel, chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. That's the last part of this vision. But it's going to be focused not on the other major players, but on Israel and what the impact is going to be on them. So this is an important revelation that is given here regarding the events of the end time that we recognize as associated with the time of the tribulation period that have to do with the 70th week of Daniel, Daniel 9:27. And as we think about this, we think about that term, Antichrist, and we recognize there are many who have come into this world at some time or another, in one way or another, that are associated with Antichrist. And the terms that are used of Antichrist, it can be singular or it can be plural, found in 1 John 2:18-22. Chapter 4, verse 3, and then 2 John, chapter 7, are where we find references to the Antichrist. But there are other places and other terms that are used as well. While there are these other many different individuals who may be called Antichrist, the one that's dealt with in this passage that we've just looked at would be the sort of the culmination, the distillation of the Antichrist in one person who is opposed to Jesus Christ in a very specific and tangible way with clear intentionality. Now, Paul refers to this person as the man of lawlessness or the man of sin, depending on which translation you're looking at. And so it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. That's, again, 2 Thessalonians 2, 4. So one of the things that we want to recognize as we've looked at this passage and realize there's a lot that we're trying to get a little bit of a handle on, and while there are some elements of it that are not as defined as others, it is enough there to recognize that this passage is dealing with the same person who is referenced in the New Testament as well. And what we know is he is not going to prevail. He is a person that we would say is out of control until he is put under control. And that's in God's timing. The Antichrist will fail. Christ will be victorious. Revelation 19 is very clear on that. And we as believers, as Paul has referenced many, many times, we are in Christ. And so we will be victorious ultimately with him as being those who are in Christ. And so as such, we can press on in the face of all the pressures, all the difficulties that we may be facing here and now. And we should realize, as we've gone through this chapter and saw all of the things that were causing great difficulty and harm on Israel, and many other people on the periphery are going to be impacted as well. The circumstances that we are dealing with, while they are annoying, are nothing compared to some of the things that are yet coming. So we can take heart to know that we are in Christ, no matter what comes our way. We have victory in Jesus, and that will pull us through whatever circumstances we have to deal with.